Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu.
WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Julian Marshall, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Five former Halliburton employees are blowing the whistle on the giant military subcontractor. They have stories of extravagant overpricing, of a culture of fear, intimidation, and secrecy. This at the company that Vice President Dick Cheney ran for 5 years. Tonight On Point, Halliburton whistleblowers tell all. But first, the U.S. State Department issued a revised terrorism report today, correcting inaccuracies from an earlier report released in April. Findings in the initial report were used by senior officials as evidence of the Bush administration's success in the war on terror. As it turns out, the report overstated a decline in terrorism-related deaths and severely understated the number of people injured in terrorist attacks. Earlier in the month on NBC's Meet the Press, Secretary of State Colin Powell called the mistakes very embarrassing and blamed them on bad data collection, not political considerations, a point he made again to reporters today.
We have only one goal with this report, and that is to accurately reflect the pattern of terrorism that existed throughout the world during the period of the report. The report is not designed to make our efforts look better or worse, or terrorism look better or worse, but to provide the facts to the American people.
Well, Josh Meyer covers terrorism for the Los Angeles Times. I asked him how plausible it is that the mistakes in the State Department terrorism report were data errors.
It's possible. It's, I wouldn't want to sort of take a guess as to exactly how it happened. I can tell you Powell is apparently furious about this. I mean, I've talked to many people in the office, and he has called a lot of people in and sort of given them a good talking to about this. And if you saw his demeanor today, you can tell that he's very unhappy about it. Whether or not other people skewed the information, it remains to be seen. But I do know that he holds his associates and underlings every bit as responsible as the CIA and this new TTIC, which is the Terrorist Threat Integration Center, because his people vouched for the report and released it with their name on it.
So where do we stand with these revised statistics in the war on terror?
Well, it's hard to say. I think people play around with numbers to their advantage all the time, so I'm always a little skeptical of that. What happened was they had released the report earlier in April, late April, saying that there was a significant decrease in terrorism activity. Now the new figures show that there has been an increase, but it's hard to tell exactly from the way they presented the information exactly how serious it is. For instance, I think there were 208 acts of international terrorism in 2003, which they say is a slight increase, but there was a significant increase in the number of people injured. There was an increase in people killed, but the huge increase is the number of people injured went from 2013 last year to 3,646.
So what was the data that was omitted that allowed the original report to talk in terms of success?
There was several different things. One of them was they cut off the date at November 11th, so any terrorist attacks that happened after that just weren't included, which is strange, and we can't really figure out exactly why that happened. They said it was a publishing deadline, but they could have always submitted or circulated an insert into the report afterwards, which they didn't do. After November 11th, there were at least 63 people killed in terrorist attacks in Turkey alone. They also said that they weren't including terrorist attacks if nobody was killed in that, which I don't think it was the case in years before. You could tell today that he was really not happy about this. And I think that this is just one of several examples. It brings up two problems. One is whether or not you can trust the intelligence that they're gathering, and two, whether they're able to sort of fairly and independently and objectively analyze that and present it to the president or to the cabinet secretaries and to the American people. So when the report first came out, Armitage and others really seized on that as proof that we were winning the war on terrorism, which was very handy for the administration. I think today what they're saying is that this doesn't mean that we're losing the war on terrorism just because there's been more attacks.
Why do you think, Josh, as somebody who's been with this story for some time, that Colin Powell keeps on coming back to it and seems determined to nail it?
I think he does want to set the record straight. I think that, this is just one of several examples in recent months where his credibility is really on the line, and I think he takes it personally. I mean, you know, first we obviously had the intelligence in Iraq and whether or not he was sort of misled by the CIA and others. I know he was furious about that as well. In this case, though, today he said that as soon as the State Department knew that the report had mistakes, they jumped on it right away and released the report. And with all due modesty, I think it was only after I wrote a front-page story about it that they really jumped on it. I cited a letter from Congressman Henry Waxman in which Waxman said that he was very upset that the numbers appeared to be skewed and he wanted it looked into. And for at least 6 weeks after that, I think, nothing happened. And Waxman even said that he hadn't heard back from the State Department. And then the story ran and then they jumped on it. So I'm not sure that it is completely in the interest of setting the record straight.
So you're suggesting that had there not been a challenge, the figures might have stood?
Yes, certainly a challenge from Congressman Waxman. But the fact that it was on a front page of a newspaper that's syndicated around the world, I don't think helped either. I heard that there was a lot of sort of infighting within the State Department about what to do about this, whether or not to sort of revise it quietly or take some time and redo it. And after it came out in the media, they didn't have a choice. Somebody who's in the State Department told me that they really played this one badly, that if they had initially just came out and said, hey, you know, our data's wrong, we're going to reissue the report, none of this would have happened. But they didn't do that, even weeks after they were called on it by Congressman Waxman and a few other people.
Now, Colin Powell also spoke today about one of the latest victims of terrorism, the South Korean hostage, Kim Sun-il, who has been executed in Iraq. What did he have to say?
He obviously condemned that, and it puts him in a hard position because it's very awkward to say that, you know, you should ignore this. But I think he's hoping that countries like South Korea stay the course and don't pull out their troops, certainly, as a result of that. And I think South Korea has said that it is sending civilians home, but it's going to keep its military presence there.
Josh Meyer, many thanks.
Very welcome.
Josh Meyer covers terrorism for the Los Angeles Times. He spoke to us from Washington. Last March, government watchdog groups cried foul when Dick Cheney's former company won billions in government contracts in Iraq. Now, new problems for Halliburton. Bribery allegations in Nigeria. Defense Department auditors holding a magnifying glass to Halliburton's files. Hearings in Congress. And five former Halliburton employees shining a harsh light on the company's spending controls. Your tax dollars, they say, are paid for embroidered towels for Halliburton on employees and housed consultants in super expensive Kuwaiti hotels. This hour on Point, former Halliburton employees lift the cover on Halliburton. Congressman Henry Waxman has been pushing hard to include the former employees in hearings in front of Congress. Joshua Chaffin is Washington correspondent for the Financial Times and joins us now. Thanks for being with us, Joshua.
Thanks for having me.
Defense Department auditors are looking into Halliburton's finances. What are they finding? What have they found?
Well, the Defense Department's auditing group has come back and found systemic problems in the way that Halliburton keeps track of its subcontracts in Iraq. It looks like there's been quite a lot of mismanagement, that there's been a huge volume of work, and that while some of this could be justified by the initial invasion and sort of the fog of war, that there's very little attention to cost or budgets after that. They've withheld, actually, about $186 million so far in payments to Halliburton for, amid concerns, I guess, that Halliburton's overcharged the government for meals, and they still are investigating further.
Well, at the same time, Joshua, as those Defense Department auditors are going about their work, California Democratic Congressman Henry Waxman, ranking minority member of the House Committee on Government Reform, is aggressively pursuing charges of mismanagement at Halliburton. I asked him why he's pushing for hearings in Congress when Defense Department auditors are already looking into alleged mismanagement at Halliburton.
Well, I think Congress needs to evaluate a number of things. Why Halliburton got a contract without competition, if it's a cost-plus contract, which it is, why it got one when it has a history of overcharging. And now with this cost-plus contract, we see that they've overcharged again in substantially larger amounts than ever before for the work that they're doing. And now with the information we're getting from whistleblowers, it just seems like they are gouging the taxpayers of the United States.
I mean, you clearly want more than a rap on the knuckles for Halliburton, but what exactly?
Well, I don't think we are to be handling the contracting in Iraq and the way we're doing it. First of all, a lot of the contracting need not be done through these private contractors, but if there are projects to be done through the private sector, we ought to have competition, because competition usually means that we can evaluate the bids and see which are lower. And not only that, if you don't have competition and you give a monopoly, then you've just got to exercise very careful oversight to be sure that we're not being overcharged.
So there is an alternative in your mind, even at this late stage in the conflict, to working with Halliburton?
Well, if not Halliburton, someone else. But if it's going to be Halliburton, we ought to set up a system where they're not making the decision how much they'll be paid, because you can't trust them. They're overcharging.
You've mentioned the Halliburton whistleblowers already and their testimony, but why haven't they been allowed to put that before Congress?
Well, we raised that point because these whistleblowers were willing and anxious to make their statements publicly, but the Republicans are in charge of calling the hearings and deciding, for the most part, who the witnesses are. We can make recommendations. They rejected the whistleblowers when we had a hearing last week, but after raising a public fuss over it, they backed down and agreed they would give us another day of hearings later in July. Now, we are entitled procedurally in the minority, once there is a hearing, to submit a petition and demand another day of hearing with the witnesses of our own choice. And so, recognizing that, the Republicans decided to be more collegial and cooperative. So we're going to hear from these whistleblowers.
We are indeed later in this program. That was California Congressman Henry Waxman, the ranking minority member on the House Committee on Government Reform. He spoke to us from Washington. And still on the line, Joshua Chaffin, Washington correspondent for the Financial Times. Is this political grandstanding, do you think, on Waxman's part? I mean, is he a one-man crusade?
I think inevitably with Halliburton, it's hard to separate the politics out from the business because the company was headed by Vice President Cheney from 1995 to 2000. So it is an effective issue for Democrats, and it's an easy way for them to suggest that there's been cronyism in the White House and with the administration. So I think that's inevitably part of the issue, and the Republicans have also flagged that up.
I mean, the congressman spoke of the Defense Department withholding money from Halliburton. Is the company currently making any money in Iraq?
It's hard to know exactly how they're doing in Iraq. We had a story this week saying that the executives are actually a lot more concerned about Iraq, and this is not just limited to Halliburton. But one of the problems for Halliburton specifically is that under this contract with the Pentagon, they undertake all sorts of tasks, whether it's building bases, feeding troops, etc., and they use their own money to finance those tasks. They then submit bills to the government to be reimbursed. And the problem that they're encountering is that they're facing a long delay in the repayment for those bills. And at the same time, the government, it looks like the Pentagon is trying to discount some of the bills because of disputes. So I think it's probably hurting the company's cash flow to some degree, at least on those specific contracts. And the company also has to pay to borrow money, has to pay interest to finance those tasks. So the argument from their side is that it isn't as lucrative as people may think it is.
We've got these Defense Department auditors holding a magnifying glass to Halliburton's file. We've got the hearings in Congress. What's the end point of these investigations?
I think the investigations themselves will be the final word. I think these auditors' reports are interesting. I think they're very serious findings, but I think it's worth pointing out that the problems are not limited to Halliburton and Iraq. The GAO has said that they've found systemic problems in the way the Pentagon is accounting for its subcontractors. And the problem is that the government has increasingly pushed to outsource a lot of these tasks, but they've trimmed their own staff who would oversee this. So I think it's a wider problem. But I do think that the whistleblowers coming forward, I think that adds very kind of graphic details to what till now has been sort of a Washington bureaucratic fight. And I think that their testimony next month, depending on the details they provide, I think it could be pretty riveting.
Joshua Chaffin, many thanks for that. Joshua Chaffin, Washington correspondent for the Financial Times. We're talking tonight about Halliburton, oversight of contractors in Iraq, and your taxpayers' dollars. Is Halliburton doing what it takes to get the job done, or grossly mismanaging your dollars, are we doing enough to police private contractors overseas? Is Halliburton too easy a target for people opposed to the war, for people who dislike Vice President Dick Cheney? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Julian Marshall, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Julian Marshall, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight with former Halliburton employees who say your tax dollars are being thrown to the wind on perks and favours in Iraq. Do you trust that your tax dollars are building a democracy in Iraq? Or do you fear that they are being wasted on bribes, perks and bad management? Is it really possible to have best business practices in a war zone? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me from Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, is Marita Young. She worked for Halliburton in Kuwait from December 2003 to May 2004 when she updated contractor paperwork. When she complained of overspending to Pentagon auditors, she was told she was providing too much information. She left Halliburton in mid-May. Good evening and welcome, Marita Young.
Good evening, Julian.
Also joining me from Houston, Texas, is Henry Bunting. He ordered supplies ranging from towels to trucks from U.S. troops in Iraq. He was stationed in Kuwait with Halliburton from June 2003 to August 2003. He testified before the Senate Democratic Policy Committee in February 2004 about what he saw when he worked at Halliburton. Welcome, Henry Bunting.
Thank you, Julian. Happy to be with you.
Mary DeYoung, can I start with you? What is your story?
I went to work for Halliburton. It was my second experience. I'd worked for them in Kosovo and was recruited to the Kuwait operation by sub-managers. And I expected it to be a very efficient, first-class organization. I expected
Why did you think that?
Well, of course, the operation in Kosovo was at its peak. It was very expensive, but it was a full-blown operation, operation maintenance, construction, all kinds of personnel and service support services were being provided. There was some waste there, but at least you saw a product and you saw that the soldiers were getting support and services.
But it was all very different in Kuwait.
Oh, absolutely. And I went to Kuwait because I am a former soldier. I'd served in 2nd Infantry Division, 2nd Armored Cavalry Regiment, 4th Infantry Division, and even the tough hombre reservists were coming over there at the time that I was recruited. And I had served with the tough hombres down in Texas. So because I was no longer a soldier, I felt that this would be an ideal way to provide direct support to soldiers.
So there was very much an underlying military commitment on your part. When did you start seeing problems?
Right away. I was rather shocked out in the desert. I was working for a man who was moved from a senior-level management out to the desert. But what he was experiencing as a manager was that a lot of personnel who were recruited had absolutely no military experience, and they had no logistics experience, no subcontracts experience, no inventory management experience. And so in the initial phases of the project, people were not keeping records. They were not keeping personnel accountability at a time when there was an IED that was detonated by Egyptian police at a checkpoint a couple days before Christmas. And personnel accountability was extremely lax.
And the particular thing you picked up on was the amount of money that Halliburton was paying for laundry.
I was moved down to the subcontracts department because down there the problems had come to light, and I had helped the manager out in the desert to more or less try to get his subcontracts under control to actually identify the number of contracts that he had. He was told he had about 23, 24 contracts. In fact, he had actually over 40 and counting. And I was sent down to help to prepare for the various audits that were going on. one set of accounts by one company, one line item for $1.2 million a month for laundry. And when I just eyeballed it, it looked to me like it was extremely high. I just couldn't imagine, you know, for one line item when the statement of work had said that you would have approximately 3,500 soldiers per month. So I ran a couple of approximations and sent information up through the our Halliburton chain of command. And in the first response, I was told by a brand new manager, because his boss, the man who had recruited him, had said he didn't want all that information. He had said, "Are you trying to get this, make this company look bad?" And I said, "No, I'm not trying to make the company look bad. I'm trying to fix a problem." You know, I said, "I don't know how much government experience you have, but I have 10 years. Plus, I had grants as a civilian from the federal government. And I know that when you have grants, you've got to keep good records and you've got to demonstrate your price reasonableness. Okay. And I know that if you make an effort to fix it, you get credit for that."
Okay, Marie. So, now, I understand that you came to the conclusion that Halliburton was actually paying the subcontractor about $100 per 15-pound bag of laundry.
Correct.
If I could just bring in Henry Bunting here. And did you have a similar experience of waste and mismanagement when you were working for Halliburton?
Yes, there was a lot of waste and mismanagement and overpricing because the ongoing philosophy in the procurement group was cost plus, don't worry about the price, just place the order. The towels was one of them where unembroidered towels were about $1.50, embroidered towels were roughly $5 each, and they wanted to get the towels embroidered without the proper bidding procedure on it.
Marie DeYoung, when you raise the kinds of problems, the kinds of doubts that you had with management, instead of being congratulated for bringing it to their attention, the response was somewhat different.
The approach of the management was basically close out as many of these accounts as you can, because if we close them out, they won't be audited, which made no sense to me. One account for soda, when I saw how they were billing 37,200 cases of soda, but actually delivering, the log was attached to every bill, and the log showed 37,200 cans of soda were being delivered instead of cases. So ran the numbers, and it looked like it was three or four times the amount. When I took that, I was basically told I was making a big deal out of nothing. But then when I continued to push it, two investigators actually went down to the site just as I was going to go down and visit it myself. They went down to the site and came back and said to me, "You're right." But it was never fixed. And then the contract was renewed at an actual higher price. It turned out to be about $1.50 a can of soda, just dropped off. We could have gotten that same can of soda from AFIS for about 30 cents a can.
Henry Bunting, you mentioned embroidered towels. Was that the worst abuse you saw?
No, there wasn't. The exercise equipment for the Morale, Welfare, and Recreation Group, I had placed two purchase orders, totaled the value of about $110,000 there. There were two additional requisitions to be placed for basically identical equipment, and the decision was made to place that stuff through a subcontract. I don't know what happened to it, but when I placed the order, I saved $60,000. There could have been that much saved by placing the other two requisitions. Other abuses included going out and telling the vendor, "We don't care what the price is, keep it under $2,500. We also instructed Halliburton supervisors, when they did requisitions, make sure you keep them under $2,500. That way we don't have to go out and get them quoted. And make sure your estimated cost per requisition never exceeded that $2,500 amount."
Okay, Henry Bunting,
like
do stay with us. Mary DeYoung, can we just come back to you in a moment? Because
sure.
I'd just like to bring in from Bridgewater, Connecticut, Dan Briody, author of The Halliburton Agenda, The Politics of Oil and Money and the Iran Triangle Inside the Secret World of the Carlyle Group. Welcome, to On Point, Dan Brady. Are you surprised by what you've been hearing from Marie de Jonge and Henry Bunting?
No, it's not very surprising at all, especially when you consider the history of this company. And it's, you know, we should clarify a little bit that it's not, you know, Halliburton and its subsidiary KBR, which is really what we're talking about in these instances. KBR, both are Texas-based companies, 80-year histories, but they're very different type of companies. KBR has been a very political company since day one. And they are no stranger to these exact charges that we're hearing, to overcharging the government and the taxpayer. It has happened since World War II, Vietnam, Bosnia, Kosovo, Somalia, and now in Iraq and Afghanistan. So this is really nothing new to see what's happening here. And I think to some extent you could chalk it up to, the fog of war. It's very difficult to keep control of costs and audit yourself during these challenging times. However, how would we even know to some extent, because it's the same company that's been doing this business for all of these events. So maybe somebody else could do it and actually keep track of their costs.
Because we actually approached Halliburton for a response to the kinds of statements that Marie de Jonge and Henry Bunting were making. Their response was, our employees have delivered 100% under severe time constraints and hazardous working conditions. That fact sometimes gets a bit lost, Halliburton says, but our employees know it and our client knows it, and ultimately that is what is important. Your response to that, Dan Brody?
Well, it's hard to call 100%, you know, driving empty trucks back and forth across the country, not delivering any goods or services of any kind, so that you can build a government and increase your profits. It's hard to call that 100%. You know, they're and at the same time, you know, these employees, you know, two of which you have on the phone right now, these employees are making good money with no taxes. And you compare that to some of the money that the soldiers are making. Some soldiers have to, you know, protect these guys as they're going on these difficult routes and dangerous routes. You're looking at an enormous discrepancy in salary between the soldiers and the Halliburton employees. So, yes, they are doing a difficult job. Yes, it is very dangerous. And yes, they volunteered to go over there. They were not drafted, and they're getting paid to do it. So, at the same time, that doesn't excuse Halliburton from overcharging the taxpayer.
Marie de Jonge, that was something that particularly troubled your conscience, was it not? The relative luxury that Halliburton employees were living in compared to U.S. soldiers serving in Iraq.
Absolutely, and not all Halliburton employees enjoyed that luxury. When I worked in operations, I was out in the desert living in a container, which was still better than the soldiers. The soldiers were living in tents, and we lived in containers. But the procurement people and the finance people and the headquarters people are all living in 5-star hotels, and they're having towels delivered every day, personal laundry. They have one pair of pants, one shirt, one pair of undergarments taken from their room every morning and then delivered, pressed. I called it the Kempinski crease each day. Now, meantime, you've got soldiers and you have truck drivers living in tents.
Henry Bunting, why did you decide to go public with your story? Dan Brody there suggests that you probably were earning very good salaries, tax-free there in Kuwait.
Well, the salary itself was about $110,000 a year if I'd stayed there for the year. So, yes, the money was good. The reason I decided to go public was we were going through an audit sometime in the June-July period. And the supervisor from the regional office was over, and one night we had a discussion about the auditors being there, and she wanted to make sure that all the Halliburton employees only presented Halliburton in the most positive light. I spoke up and said I would not lie to the government or anybody else about what Halliburton's doing. If asked a question, I would answer it fully. If you want to send me home now, because I'm not lying for anybody.
Okay, let's just take a quick call from Peter. He's calling from Canton, Massachusetts. Peter, what did you want to say?
Well, I wanted to respond to right around the break when we talked about the cash flow troubles that Halliburton may be having now and its effect on its profitability. It really comes right down to what your last three guests are talking about, which is if you minded the store in the first place, you might not be having this pushback from the federal government on not reimbursing for costs, because if you watched your costs from the beginning, we get sold this bill of goods that Halliburton is the only company that is capable of doing this kind of work. And here we, on the other hand, are fighting around the globe for free market, competitive capitalism. And I just, want to point out that if they watched the store in the first place or watched their bills, they might not be in this heat now with their cash flow.
And Dan Brody, I suppose that's a question that we'll never know the answer to, whether Halliburton are the only company capable of doing this job.
Well, I really don't think that they are the only company capable of doing it. However, over the past 14 years, since the first log cap contract was awarded to KBR in 1992 under Dick Cheney's Defense Department, they have been virtually the only company doing this type of work. There was another company that held the contract for a short period of time called DynCorp. But that company, the Army found that Halliburton and KBR had become so ingrained into the everyday operations in Bosnia and any other ongoing contingency operations for the Army that they could not extract the company from those locations. So they carved out those pieces of the contract and kept them with KBR. So this whole concept of privatization and outsourcing and open market competition sort of fell by the wayside back then when they realized that they really couldn't allow any other companies to compete because it just would have been too disruptive to their ongoing operations.
Let's just get a quick answer from Marie DeYoung. I mean, were you aware that Halliburton, Kellogg Brown Root, had that kind of monopoly on this sort of operation when you were working for them in Kosovo and then in Kuwait?
Well, yes. When I was recruited, I was recruited by senior managers to Kuwait, and I was told in the spring, in May 4th or 5th, when I was first asked to go, this is going to be a $7 billion contract. It's going to be 5 years. It's going to be your future. And if I had seen the kind of quality, it would be justified. But towards the end, when I left, not only did I have direct evidence, verbatim quotes of Henry Bunting's observation that the people purchasing had been told, to keep their orders down so that they couldn't be observed, to keep them under $25 so that you don't have to compete. Also, all of the services that the Army expected us to self-perform, the first-class dining facilities, the laundry operations, the trucking, it was all subcontracted out. And the fact of the matter is, most of the subcontracting operations are the ones who are at financial risk, not Halliburton. And they are quite capable of doing these operations without having Halliburton be the middleman.
Marie DeYoung, a former Halliburton employee, stay with us, please. And you too, Henry Bunting, former Halliburton employee. And Dan Brody, author of The Halliburton Agenda, The Politics of Oil and Money. We're talking tonight about Halliburton with former employees who tell their stories from inside the trenches. Are you alarmed by what you're hearing? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Julian Marshall, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. This is On Point. I'm Julian Marshall, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking tonight to former Halliburton employees who say your tax dollars are being grossly mismanaged in Iraq. What do we really know about what's going on in Iraq? Where your tax dollars are going? Is Halliburton too easy a target for people opposed to the war? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Still with us from Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, is Marie DeYoung. She worked for Halliburton in Kuwait from December 2003 to May 2004 when she complained of overspending the Pentagon orders. She was told she was providing too much information. Also with us from Houston, Texas, Henry Bunting. He ordered supplies ranging from towels to trucks for U.S. troops in Iraq. He was stationed in Kuwait with Halliburton from June 2003 to August 2003. From Bridgewater, Connecticut, Dan Brody, author of The Halliburton Agenda, The Politics of Oil and Money. And joining us now, Steve Schooner, Associate Professor of Law and Co-Director of the Government Procurement Law Program at George Washington's Law School. Thank you for joining us, Steve Schooner.
Thanks for inviting me.
We've heard from two former employees of Halliburton. What could their testimony mean for the company?
Well, based on what I've heard so far and based on what apparently they've been telling Representative Waxman's committee, none of this is going to bode well for Halliburton. If we were just to talk about the government's potent arsenal of remedies, keep in mind that because they're a government contractor, the government has basically unlimited options. For example, it has the right to recover any actual cost that it spent that were inappropriate. It has the right to terminate contracts. It has the right to suspend or ultimately debar Halliburton or KBR from further contracts. There's also a host of civil remedies, particularly under the Civil False Claims Act. And then if, in fact, fraud was actually proven, there's always the possibility that individuals or groups of people from Halliburton would have the opportunity to be prosecuted and go to jail. So assuming the worst, there's a number of terrible things that could happen. But, of course, a lot of this depends on the actual facts.
So the possibility of a civil suit, criminal suits, who would bring them?
Well, if there's going to be a civil or a criminal suit against Halliburton, and the bottom line is the Department of Justice would be the United States government's representative in that case. There's a number of different organizations within the Justice Department that could do it, but the Justice Department would handle the litigation.
Could taxpayers themselves go after the company?
Yes. We have in the United States what we call the Key Tam statute. Some refer to it as the whistleblower statute. And there's always the possibility that an employee could come forward as long as they have new information and sue Halliburton in the government's name. We would call them the relator. And if the Justice Department liked the lawsuit, they could take it over. And whether or not the Justice Department took it over, if the individual was successful, they would share in whatever recovery the government ultimately received.
Now let's take a call from Donna in South Wellesley, Massachusetts. Donna, are you worried about the way your dollars are being spent by Halliburton?
Absolutely. And by the way, it's Dana from South Wellfleet. I'm sorry.
That's okay.
Yes, actually, and I think this goes up to the highest executive offices in the country. Dick Cheney still gets, as I understand, a pension from Halliburton, which is something I could be set for life with if I had the same amount. It really bothers me how unhealthy our democracy is when all the machinery of government was borne down on President Clinton for lying about an illicit love affair, when Cheney's lies, Bush's lies, and the money Halliburton's making off the blood of our soldiers and Iraqi citizens is scarcely being questioned by the mainstream media or the public. I call publicly for the impeachment of Mr. Cheney and Mr. Bush.
Okay, strong stuff there, Dana. Dan Brody, do you think that this entire debate about Halliburton's financial accountability is being clouded, though, by politics?
Is it inevitable? Of course it's being clouded by politics. But, you know, that should not detract from what the real issues are here. You have to remember that it's Halliburton itself that brought politics into its business and made politics the cornerstone of how it was going to gain government contracts and profit from government contracts. This company had a 40-year relationship with Lyndon Johnson that was among the most unique relationships between a business and a politician that this country has ever seen, and it was incredibly mutually beneficial. So, I don't have a lot of sympathy for Halliburton being in the middle of a political debate in this country in an election year when it is Halliburton itself that uses politics to do its business. So they're really reaping what they've already sown at this point.
Okay, let's take another call from Rami in Hackensack, New Jersey. And I think this one could possibly be answered by Marie de Young or Henry Bunting. Rami, what did you want to ask?
Yes, hi. Yes, actually, my comment was just regarding the comment before on the luxury some of the Halliburton employees are living in, five-star hotels, etc. I just don't see this as a big point in the sense that it's a company that regularly offers its employees this kind of benefit wherever they go in the world. And I happen to work for another international organization that also sends people all over the world. This particular assignment happens to be more dangerous than normal assignments. So why not give them the same thing they normally offer them?
Marie de Young, what's your response to that?
If the contract was a commercial contract, or if it was a contract for a very wealthy government, I could see it. If you're working for the Saudi Arabia government, in fact, the Halliburton employees who are already over there for 5 or 7 years, sure, let them live in hotels. But this log cab contract is about being the core support group for the Army and the core support logistics group. That's what it's about. And I was shocked. I mean, I'm a published author. I've written about whether or not women should be in ground combat. This has given me an awful lot to think about. I've served in the field in 1993 when soldiers lived in tents and we had computerized requisition systems. They could order parts on computers in 1993. This is a world-class oil company that wants to put its employees, unskilled employees, oh, by the way.
But you're of the opinion, Marie de Young, that Halliburton employees working in Kuwait and Iraq should, in fact, be living in tents just like the soldiers.
I think that they should be have the priority of taking care of the soldiers' needs first, and then after the soldiers' needs are taken care of, then if you want to put people up in more luxurious accommodations, if you're not going to charge the government for it, I can see it. But I can't see when we have the AMC logistics people living in tents and sometimes in containers, why are we staying in five-star hotels? But also, you know, as I was saying, oh, by the way, these people are not skilled. The man who was just fired, okay, Jack Stanley, his son was one of the managers, unskilled, and his circle of friends were controlling the data flow, depriving data to the auditors. He was controlling data flow, and yet part of the problem a year ago brought back to be part of the Tiger team.
Henry Bunting, were you very conscious that the kind of money that was being wasted was public money? Is that what offended you?
Yes, it did. The amount of waste and the total lack of concern for even trying to save, a few dollars here or there. There was just absolutely complete disregard for it. And that disregard is inherent in the corporate culture of Halliburton. They don't care, and they won't. They will continue to eat at the government trough until such time as somebody says, hey, enough's enough. And the only way they're going to do that is to prosecute them for the abuses.
T.D. Almond, calling from New York. What did you want to say?
Well, first of all, I want to congratulate Dan Briotti on his book. I read it cover to cover before it was published. I'm the author of a book that covers some of the same territory that's out now called Rogue State. And I, try and write about Cheney, and I just learn all sorts of things from him that I never suspected. And I, besides congratulating him on the book and the other people for standing up on this important issue, I'd like to get their judgment of who's wagging the dog here. Was it, Cheney appears at times just stupid and at other times devilishly clever. And did he sort of engineer Halliburton into becoming this eminence grise of the American war-making machine? Or was his tenure, as other people say, as head of Halliburton, a disaster for the company? That's a subject I'd really like to know what they think about.
And okay, let's just get Marie de Young's opinion about that. I mean, working as you did at the front line, do you have a view about that?
I wanted to make sure that our soldiers were taken care of. I went to visit Paul Kern, the head of the AMC, to express my concerns about Halliburton, not just about Halliburton, but about the kinds of support that soldiers were getting in the field, and also about the place of subcontractors on the battlefield. I honestly believe that the generals who have left were remained standing after Rumsfeld fired people who spoke the truth, that it would take hundreds of thousands of soldiers to do that war correctly, to stabilize Iraq. And all those generals who were fired, the people who were left standing had to do what they could do to take care of soldiers. Those of us who were prior service, who signed up for a number of companies like Halliburton, we wanted to make sure that soldiers were taken care of. I don't know about the vice president. I have no opinion one way or the other. But what I do think is it was a very tragic mistake
Okay,
to
let's
try
take
to
a call
depend
from,
on companies.
Let's take a call from Peter in Ellison, Wisconsin, a question I think that might be answered by Steve Schooner. Peter, what did you want to ask?
Well, I'd like to see somebody in the U.S. government, an elected official, show the guts and the courage to actually force Halliburton to create a fund from their profits, and payments from that fund would go to the widows and the orphans and those that are maimed by this war, because basically this war, when you blow the smoke out of the way, this war is about oil and it's about profits for some of these companies. And I just don't think it's right that the sons of the executives of some of these big companies are driving around in SUVs when these other kids from poor families in this country are losing their lives and coming home maimed and destroyed. So, I mean,
okay, Steve Schooner, is it even conceivable that such a law could be passed?
Well, I have to say that I'm not sure I really understand the question, but let me just throw a couple things.
Well, I think he wanted the passing of a law ordering Halliburton to pay compensation to the widows of soldiers who lost their lives in Iraq.
First of all, I think it's a bit of a stretch to suggest that Halliburton began the war. Second, let's be frank, while Halliburton may be engaged in sloppy billing, their profit rate on this work is only 2-2.5%. I also think it's important for the public to keep in mind that Halliburton has lost more than 36 employees over there. I mean, their employees are being shot at just like everyone else. And then
that's
one of the most important things to keep in mind here is that at the end of the day, the responsibility here is shared by the government. One of the reasons that the contract is being managed this way is the government doesn't have sufficient contractual oversight on the ground in Iraq. We're spread way too thin. In the 1990s, we irresponsibly reduced the acquisition workforce with this dream of outsourcing without any recognition whatsoever about the type and the quantity of acquisition professionals we needed to manage this vision that has been put forward. And I think that the government at some point has to share the responsibility. And I think it's silly to single out Halliburton because a number of contractors over there, whether it's Parsons, Bechtel, or the others, are in exactly the same boat.
Dan Brady, just a brief comment from you. The kind of mess that Halliburton now finds itself in Kuwait and Iraq is the consequence of the haste with which this war was prosecuted.
Well, I think to some extent that's true, and the haste at which the battle was escalated and the number of troops were escalated, and Halliburton was certainly caught a little bit off guard by that. But, you know, to address something that Steve Schooner was just saying, you know, about the profit margins that Halliburton gains from this business, it is true that the profit margins are not tremendous, certainly by corporate American standards. But at the same time, you know, Halliburton is going to be in Iraq for long past the June 30th deadline, probably for the foreseeable future. Okay. They now have the world's leading experts in the Iraqi oil infrastructure business, and that is going to be a very long-term profitable business for them.
Okay, Dan Brady, author of The Halliburton Agenda, The Politics of Oil and Money. Many thanks for being with us, and to you too, Steve Schooner, Associate Professor of Law and Co-Director of the Government Procurement Law Program at George Washington's Law School. Thanks to you too, Marie DeYoung in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. She worked for Halliburton in Kuwait from December 2003 to May 2004. And Henry Bunting in Houston, Texas. He ordered supplies ranging from towels to trucks for U.S. troops in Iraq. He was stationed in Kuwait with Halliburton from June 2003 to August 2003. I'm Julian Marshall, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.